was no announcement about my dog. I'm happy to be here, just with, like, all familiars.
Can't hear you.
I'm going to turn it on. Welcome back.
How's the sound? All right. So, it's Labor Day weekend. Other people are having fun. So, I also thought, let's have fun. Plus, I've been on retreat for a month. And the last 3 years, I have practically no retreat time. We started our new monastery, and even I had scheduled retreat time, but then, like at that scheduled retreat time when it was planned, something came up that was like super urgent and time sensitive and this thing and that thing, and it just happened again and again, pretty much. So I figured if I have retreat time scheduled, something big is going to happen. And then we had the Global Buddhism Conference in Berkeley, and Ajahn Brahm came, and it's like a whole year of preparing for just this big Sangha Dana. Dhamma Dana and Sangha Dana, just this big offering to the Sangha. And I thought, okay, we're done with that. And then just as soon as that was done, I'm thinking, okay, I haven't scheduled anything else. And Bhante Sujato, the founder of Sutta Central, we've been wanting to get him to come to the U.S. for the last 10 years. Now he's coming at the end of the Vasa. And INT, would you like to arrange or organize anything? Whatever you'd like for me to do, I'm happy to. But somehow, blessed be, in this last month it's been possible to just have this retreat time at our hermitage and Vimuti Kuti, called Freedom Kuti. Little cabin in the forest. It's the first one that was built in our first Vasa. This is the 10th Vasa, 10th rainy season, but it's our dry season here. Somehow it happened. Even coming up on the time, 2 weeks beforehand, 1 week beforehand, then two of the longtime friends, both are entering their big transition, means end-of-life transition, terminal diagnosis, and this kind of thing. And I'm thinking, oh, am I, maybe I'm not going to enter retreat after all. But they are both happy to just think of them and share blessings with them just by heart, mentally. And they're practitioners. I've given a lot of time to this practice already, so I'm actually not in such bad shape. They have the Dhamma. They have their practice. They've done the work of their hearts over years and years, so it's like, okay, we are together in this, and I know that, and it's good. It's good. I know I have your blessings. I have the blessings. I have my own blessings. The blessings of this heart in my path. I'm just so delighted to see, for those who've been practicing for a long time, coming to the end of life is different. Breaking down of the body is different. Coming to the end of the life is different. The great transition, great amazing transition that we call death is different. What an odyssey, oh my goodness. Those insights that you strive for years and years to obtain and were somehow out of reach, then just come right up to your door and just open it up for you and say, step through, here I am. Insights of the past are here and now in this time and these circumstances. So I'm emerging now from having a month of retreat time, and certainly there was, it was blissful to have this time sometimes. And also then it's like I seem to have accumulated some work. And then it's like having accumulated this work. Now I haven't lived in California my whole life. we are neighbors, right? I did these things. Oh, look at that. What an accumulation of the snowbank. And now I'm going to shovel. So there was something that I felt like this. And like, you know, the work, but I'm happy to do the work. This is what I want to do. I wish to have time to be able to do this. Just the time and the space and the opportunity to apply the teachings to just do the darn work of my heart that just is calling for and needs to be done. It's tough. There was the grunginess of it. It was completely, I was going to say completely humbling, but completely humiliating. I love it. I mean, hummus like the ash. I was just going to stand under the tree and with my feet just, you know, touching the earth, and oh, how wonderful. Oh, the bliss. Aho suko. In the sutta, and there's the monk who goes, the man who had family and many possessions and lots of stuff that normally people call the good things of life, and then somehow got inspired by the Dhamma teaching and went forth into monastic life with the Buddha. And then he was seen outside in the forest, standing under the trees there, even with nobody else around, just saying, Aho Sukho! Aho Sukho! It means, oh, the happiness, oh, the bliss, in the feminine gender, in the plural, Aha Sukha! Aha Sukha! Aha Sukha! I'm so delighted to have this, the end of all of the suttas, almost all of the suttas where the person becomes an arahant, then in Pali it says kattam karaniyam, it means I've done the work that needed to be done. The work that needed to be done, I have done. I've done the work that needed to be done. The work of my heart, the work of my life, I've done that work. These are the ways you can literally translate it. Kattam karaniya. It's part of their joyful announcement of their completion of the path. But this monk was saying this not even yet having become an arahant, completing the path. But then the other monks, some of them are like, that's a little bit strange. What's going on with him over there all alone by himself underneath the tree going, Aho Sukho, Aho Sukho. Oh, the bliss. Oh, the happiness. They went and talked to the Buddha about it, and the Buddha said, go ask him why he's saying that, right? Even some people were like questioning about it. It's a little bit weird, right? We know the Buddhists are peaceful and happy folk, but still, it's kind of over the top, right? If you were at Spirit Rock on a meditation retreat and somebody is just out there, oh, the bliss! Oh, the happiness! Standing under the tree, then you go to the retreat managers and, excuse me, isn't this supposed to be a silent retreat? And there's somebody out there underneath the tree who's talking. They've broken their precept of silence. What's going on? Can you check? Are they somebody who's on medication? Have they gone off? Are they taking too much of it? I know the inside story with the retreat managers. You see all these things, right? Yeah. And so then they went to ask him about it. The Buddha said, go ask him. You're asking me? Go ask him. And, you know, wherefore, venerable? Aho Sukho, standing all alone by yourself beneath the trees. And he says, I had carts, I had chariots, equal fantastic car, right? The best car. And then also the work of vehicles, the fleet. And I had laborers, I had employees, I had many family members. Great family and my health and my wealth and my possessions and all of that. And now I just realized there was no moment that my mind was not occupied with all of these things, all of these possessions and all of this work and all of their family and all of that. There was no moment that my mind was not occupied. And now I've come out here here into the forest and entered into the monastic life was the teaching, the Dhamma of the Blessed One, and I'm experiencing the bliss of having just put all of that down and becoming present. Have you experienced it ever? And time to do the work, deeper work of my heart. Yeah. Inspired by the Dhamma. You might think, oh, it's such a pitiful story. He had all that stuff and gave it up. He had a good family and gave it up. What? Didn't he have all success, all the success in life? Did he have some psychological problem? What's going on with that? And according to the story, it wasn't even like he was one of those people who had all the successes and all the family and all the riches and all the stuff, but was still with too much, maybe some anxiety. But he said he only realized it yet afterwards, and just when there was the freedom of his mind being occupied. Full up with all these things, one after another after another. Oh, the bliss to have this time, to have this space, as we also now have, even this lovely sala that we're in here on the bay with the lovely roof and windows and tile floor, and all of this is here supporting us. Are we able to allow ourselves to feel that? There are many troubles in the world, right? There are many things difficult going on. There are many family concerns. Also, we have the diagnoses of the doctors, ourselves and others. And all of these things are there. The stupid people are wrecking the earth. And, you know, so many things like this to feel bad about, to feel concerned about, to feel trouble about. Very reasonably, right? I know last year you were studying the Paramis. Now this Vasa, our community, our monastic, Damodarini monastic community, decided that we wish, by poll, we had a poll, decided we wished also to have focus on the Paramis. So during my retreat time, I gave a little bit of time further to the Paramis. And under the Kanti Parami, then patience, yes? Patience or patient endurance, and part of it is like to endure the wrongs done to one. And then there is the list of the wrongs that can be done to one. The wrongs that can be done to one personally by others, the wrongs that can be done to us by the world, the wrongs that are done by others to our beloved ones, whether our family members, our dear ones, the environment, the country, the society, the world, all of these wrongs that can be done, and then there's the wrongs that we can do to ourselves. Right. If we consider like the things, we only think about the external wrongdoings, then that is all the external wrongdoing stuff, but what about the thoughts to ourselves that are putting ourselves down, that are under, I mean, we don't like the things that are harmful externally to see them. To anybody else or to anything else, we feel badly about those things. But what about the thinking that's to ourself like that? Those, how do you patiently endure sitting during the meditation and the voices from the past or from the present? It's like, what? How can you have forgotten what your meditation theme was after reciting it? How many times are this kind of thing like this, and you're darn it, oh, and everything's, the body is hurting, and what good is this lousy, rotten body that's breaking down like this, and then a mind that can't even remember and keep track of anything, and how we can think and abuse and undermine and doubt and criticize ourselves. So even how to be patient with the arising of these so many conditions, habit patterns that may be there, that they have the chance to arise. And really, you know, these things are almost always, they have reactive momentum in them. And and there's something in there unsettled, something in there that's like hurt, and something that's pained that just really just needs some love and care and attention sometimes. And you know, whether it's someone else who loves us, who's able to just sit with us and just give us a hug from the heart and just hold us with all of our pains and disabilities and malfunctions of various body parts and mental parts and all of these things, and just hold and love and care for that, and just know that. And you know, they don't even have to try to fix anything or tell you anything or anything like that, but just to be able to be present and love and hold and care for you like this, and to sit with yourself like that, with this beautiful Parami, beautiful Parami teachings, which are able, each one of them, able to hold, able to touch and hold absolutely everything and anything and everything exactly as it is, and also able to pass through absolutely everything like that kind of love and compassion from the really loving and understanding people that's like through thick and thin, come what may, whatever it may be. I've seen you in your beautiful times, and I've seen you at your worst, your ugliest, all of that. I love you and care for you, and I'm with you through every bit of it and beyond, right? Through thick and thin. This kind of amazing heart, giving the care to see and know and touch and hold with the freedom, giving that to ourselves, doing the work that needs to be done. So it's Labor Day weekend, and somehow managed to live through this 1 month of retreat time and then survive the drive down. My driving wasn't that actually so bad. The previous time I came down, and the person who was driving, I felt carsick. And when you sit on this seat here like this, when you feel carsick, it feels like you're going to fall off the seat. Everything is spinning around and feel kind of nauseous, but I'm going to talk about patterns. Okay, through everything, all right, it's okay. Carsick, then okay, show up carsick. Being with this. Now, someone might get carsick. Even I'm not carsick today, not yet. Who knows about the drive back? We're going back to the Hermitage tonight. But someone may be carsick and productive of unhappiness, but if we have the Dhamma, you can be carsick and be productive of happiness and grow and gain in the path because of it, because that's the power of this path. Whatever is shoveled out, whatever comes up, whatever is dished out by the world, and all the, even the very worst that we can think of internal and external things, okay, meet it with Dhamma, bring Dhamma to that, meet that with Dhamma, and what's going to come of it? Only good is going to come of it. Growth in the path is going to come from it. Blessings are going to come from it. Okay, I have this wish-fulfilling jewel. I have this wish-fulfilling gem right here, right now, with me, with the treasure of the Dhamma. I have this, come what may, whatever it is, okay. I can meet it with Dhamma. And the opportunity will be to do the work of my heart, the work of the path, whatever the path itself, in a way, is really, I mean, by path, I mean like my deepest heart's intentions, noble integrity, truthfulness, love, compassion, all these, the deep, the heart of the deep things, even paramis, we give different words, but like in the depth of them, they're the same thing in a way, right? It's just like you look at one gem and you turn it, and then it's got different facets. And you look at one and you see, oh, from this angle I see green, from this angle I see blue, from this angle I see gold. This is one gem of the Dhamma, depths of the Dhamma in our heart. So, rejoicing day. And I like to invite everyone to, if you can, maybe you feel grouchy, grumpy, negative, distrustful, or any of these things, but no, maybe not now, but later on, privately, when no one else is watching, you can try for a little while to open up and allow yourself the healthiness of this quality of mudita. Now, one of my teachers recently had a high-level birthday. 73? Some of you may say, no, that's not high level, I have surpassed. I am a mature member of the Sangha, thank you very much. 73 is practically nothing. So one of my teachers recently had 73rd birthday mudita, Thai. They use mudita for the celebration in Thai language. That's the word for having a celebration and inviting everyone to just come and rejoice together, and for the person also to rejoice themselves and be happy. And people give gifts to them and they give gifts to other people, and it's just a time to rejoice. And you know, so many times the mudita teachings, I was talking about this yesterday, emerging from retreat also, for the four Brahma Viharas. I know almost all of you, all or almost all, have studied about the four immeasurables, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. Anyone doesn't know them? Is there anyone? One person. Metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. I know you've heard these before. No? Loving kindness, compassion. What is mudita?
Sympathetic joy.
And another translation?
Gladness.
Gladness. Another translation?
Appreciative joy.
Appreciative joy. Another translation?
Gratitude.
Gratitude. Another translation?
Empathetic.
Huh?
Empathetic joy.
Empathetic joy. Any other translation?
Happiness on behalf of another.
Happiness on behalf of another. So here's the thing. Did you ever notice in the teachings on metta, loving kindness, then even you may have recited the chant in the lovely chanting group. Where's Brenda? Lovely chanting group used to recite here sometimes. I know that to all as to myself I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart of loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will, and likewise for a heart of compassion, and likewise for multiple translations of mudita. To all as to myself I will abide. But did you catch something in there? To all as to myself I will abide. Internally, externally, equally, to all as to myself, I will abide. So many teachers, so many times, have said things like, what did you say again, Phil?
Happiness on behalf of others.
Happiness on behalf of others, but very, very important. And one of the big translations that's out there that some teacher, very popular teacher, sometimes called the happiest man, happiest person in the world, has said altruistic joy. So if you talk about altruistic joy, does that include oneself? I'm just asking. No, why not? Who does it include? Everybody except me? The whole world except me. All the entire world, all living beings except me. I am the only one that is like why did the Buddha say I'm not worthy of it? Or did the Buddha say it's like, no, we're supposed to be non-self, you know, all this. But why then for the metta? Metta, loving kindness is supposed to be, is that just supposed to be loving kindness on behalf of others? How did you learn it? For you too, or no? Just for others?
No.
Just loving kindness for others, right?
No, I started with myself.
You learn to start with yourself.
Yeah.
And then sometimes also like starting with yourself and then going out and then also coming back to all boundless, to all living beings and then back into your own heart. Compassion. How about compassion? To all, compassion on behalf of all other living beings? Huh?
You start with yourself.
You start with yourself? How about mudita? Where do you start? With everybody else, right?
No.
Yeah, with the other people. Somebody else, at least. Somebody else who did something that was nice and good. And you can think of somebody, right?
No.
No?
No.
No?
No.
Oh?
It's...
Really, I've heard so many times, you know, I may have mentioned it before, but I'm going to mention it again, because there's so many times that this is being translated just as we just heard. Altruistic joy, altruism. Why, who said, does it say in the dictionary, does anyone have their tablet not turned off and they have their smartphone and they can check, does altruism include oneself or... It's at the for the sake of others, not oneself, denying oneself. Does it mean that? It means others first, always before one, for the sake of others, right? To put oneself aside, to put oneself, not to consider oneself, to consider others. Often you say altruism. I don't know. I think altruism is like altruism. Great. Wonderful. Altruism is exactly what we're talking about here. We're talking about altruistic loving kindness, altruistic compassion, altruistic mudita, altruistic upekkha, altruistic equanimity, balance, peace, harmony of mind. It's able to hold everything. Altruistic. Yes, we are. But if altruistic means excluding oneself and all for others, then... That's not what it says in the sutta. It's not what it says in the text. There are some translators who have translated it like that, especially Western translators. Even some who are normally like very like German and extremely precise and like really the faithful to the literalness of their translation, even it's like so wonky in English, but still it's faithful to the text. And yet, you look at somebody and then they took the Pali text and then they said for loving kindness, for metta, loving friendliness, and it's for oneself and for others, for everyone, and internally and externally, compassion for oneself and for others, everyone internally and externally, and then for the mudita is the joy on the behalf of others. Happiness on the behalf of others, appreciation on the behalf of others. But in a Christian culture, that's good, right? Because you're allowed to think about and to be happy for the good things that others have done. But if you rejoice in what you yourself have done, isn't it the sin of pride? Isn't that one of the deadly sins? Isn't that leading to damnation? You might not be a Christian, but then even I didn't grow up Christian, but I grew up in a Christianity imbued culture. So many ideas are there, even they're like running under the surface and pervading things, so it becomes like implicit. And then kind of, you know, just something that's even not said, but it's like, oh, you did that so nicely. And, oh, no, not at all. Really, I didn't. I did it very badly, actually. Well, you did it was so great, right? And you feel good about yourself, but you're not going to call it that. Because you just denied yourself and you just put yourself down. So I'm doing good, right? I'm supposed to depreciate myself and appreciate others. To
to be a good person, to be a moral person with integrity. Isn't it like that? Isn't that what you're... Oh, look, what a lovely shirt you have on. What a beautiful color that is. Oh, no. This is my old thing. I got it at the thrift store, and it's already stained, and, you know, it's nothing. But your outfit now, that's really nice. Oh, what lovely robes you're wearing. What a lovely outfit that is. What do you call that? I get this quite a lot. You know, people are just trying to be nice, right? And come up and, oh, what a lovely dress that is. Where did you get that? I'd like to get one like it. Maybe at the airport, they do. They say like that, yeah. Uh-huh, and I know, it's just, do they really want robes? I'm not sure. Maybe they just have some merit in some kind of something from their past life. Robes! Some strong attraction. I was riding on Amtrak a few years ago in the coastal starlight. And we have the precept that, like, this robe we're not supposed to take into the toilet. And so I left the robe, this one robe I left on the seat, and then I went down to the toilet. And then I came back to my seat, the robe was gone. Oh, who's going to want a patchwork smelly? You know what, this one probably hasn't been washed in more than a year now. It's true. I was thinking I should wash it, but no, my body is kind of warm. It's a warm evening. Why they say you shouldn't get within arm's length from the monastic. But then I came back to the seat and the robe is gone. I look around me and nobody's saying anything. Somebody took my robe? Really? Really? Why would they want it? For what? But obviously someone just felt some kind of attraction to it and wished for it and wanted it. And I remembered something, you know, Ajahn Brahm likes to teach about this. He's really not only a master of meditation and a master of Dhamma, but also a master of Vinaya, the monastic discipline. And, you know, the Buddha said that he taught Dhamma and Vinaya. Vinaya is not only monastic discipline. It's like, if you say Dhamma is theory, then Vinaya would be like the lived path, right? It means the training, the discipline, the work of the path that we do. So not only for monastic discipline. He likes to tell the story then. Like, what if something happens? What if somebody steals your robe? Then what, right? I heard the Dhamma Vinaya teaching like this. And he told the story from the Buddha's time where a monk had, like, gone to a gathering teaching of the Buddhas, and then he left behind one of his robes there and then went to walk to another locale. Went on a walking pilgrimage. At that time, the Buddhist monastics were not using chariots or carts unless they were sick. And then just walking. Everything is walking practice, walking pilgrimage. Going with the Buddha, even hundreds of them together, walking around. So walked off, and then another monk was there afterwards and saw the robe sitting there. And his robe was kind of worn out. And then that robe was good. And everybody had left. It's like, there's a robe there that's in good condition, and my robe's not in good condition, but we have precepts. Not taking what's not given, right? But, you know, it's sitting there, and there's nobody there, and it's a robe, for God's sake, right? So this is meant to be used by Buddhist monastics. Anyway, he took the robe, and he used the robe. And then time by time, then he went to the other location where that other monk was, who had left the robe behind and lost his robe, and then that other monk recognized it. Like, I would probably be able to recognize this one. Probably. Even amongst a bunch of other robes I've been wearing it for years. I know it's like unique, funky stitching places, and like where the sunshine and this, you know, so many unique things. And so he recognized the robe. And then what? It's a parajika. In the Buddhist monastic discipline,
If you take something not given worth more than a little bit, it automatically just ends your monastic life. Yikes, really? Oh dear, right? So it's one strike. One strike. Offense like that. That valuable things taken was not given. But the consultation happened, and the Buddha recommended that the monk who lost the robe should think about that robe and relinquish it. Give it up and think, this is a gift. Let whoever wishes for this robe, let them have it. Nay, whoever wishes for it, I give it to them, let them have it. Even afterwards. So the monk did that. The Buddha's advice. The Buddha is his teacher. He left home with the Buddha as his teacher. It's his robe. It was his robe. But his advice then to freely give it up to whoever would have it. And then it's like, what's it called? Post hoc? I don't know. Then to make it so it was the given gift to save this other monk's monastic life. Yeah. So then I thought about that at that time. I thought, okay, let me make this the... I imagine the robe sitting there on the train seat. Let me make this the given gift. I give this gift to whoever would like to have it. I tried to think like that. But it was a little bit difficult at that time. This was a few years ago, talking about the parami of the patience or love or equanimity or all of these other wonderful, beautiful qualities of the paramis that are so wonderful. And you just pass through, not stuck, not stuck on whatever that thing is, but able to contact that experience and able to pass through, not disassociation, but withholding, but not holding as attachment, means freely, being able to freely contact with freedom, with movement, not sticking or hitting against anywhere, yes? But work, I admit, I freely admit, I had to do a little bit of work. There's like something niggling in my heart that just wants to cause me suffering. Not be at ease, not be completely comfortable with this thing that happened. And here I am on the coastal starlight, and I still have more than maybe 24 hours left on the train. And someone here has taken my robe. What are they going to do next? A thief among us, like this. And at that time, it's before we started our Dhammadrini monastic community. And then to have the robe, actually to receive the robe, to have a set of robes like that, that time I didn't have the monastic community. And where am I going to get another robe? And I had very few things at that time. And I was out on a journey and have no clue where is another robe going to come from, right? Use it in the evening, it gets cold. It's nice to have something to wrap around you. That thinking all these kinds of things, right? Something not quite at ease. It all seems so reasonable, doesn't it? It's reasonable for me to feel righteous indignation. I've been wronged! How awful! Just being on the train like this, anyone who wanted to come up, I greeted them nicely. Anyone who wanted to talk about their life, the path, Buddhism, the Dhamma, all these things freely, you know. And then I go to the toilet and steal my robe. Seems so reasonable, doesn't it? And these are just things that I'm saying to oneself in one's mind, and just recognizing, does it have the quality of peace and freedom and ease and happiness? Like really meeting this with, like turning this towards welfare and well-being, and really like this opportunity has come for me to do the work of my heart, the work that needs to be done. Yeah, this gift of
is time and space and opportunity that no one can take away from me other than myself.
Then who is the thief?
Oh, who is the criminal, right? Shall I live like that to myself? So now I ask you, mudita, having heard what you've just heard, now how would you translate? If oneself is included 100% equally, completely, and not to go into the things that the Christian traditions very rightly and wisely sometimes warn against, the pride that really causes people such trouble, right? Pride, conceit, arrogance. It doesn't mean going into that extreme, nor the other extreme of putting oneself down, self-denial, self-depreciation, leaving oneself out, cutting oneself out, not caring for one's own mind, heart, and body, Dhamma needs. Not that. Between these two extremes is what? Is there anything, or do only those two extremes exist? In opportunity and possibility. Is it only one or the other? Has to be like self-aggrandizement or putting oneself down, denying oneself? Are those the only two possibilities? Yes, they're the only two possibilities?
No.
Lots of people will say that they are. It's one or the other. You go, if you try to stop one, you go to the other. That's the way you, like, isn't it, right? If you're going too far right, then you have to go left, don't you?
It's like near and far enemies.
Near and far enemies, yes. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, the near enemy of mudita would be sort of a vicarious joy, sort of like, oh, that must feel great. I'll bet she feels great. I can imagine what that would feel like. The far enemy would be, oh boy, I've got a new car. I feel great.
Mm.
And with, I think mudita, if it's really deep mudita, it's generous.
Yes.
There's not self in it. You can be generous towards yourself without being.
All these are qualities of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When there's real, true, pure-hearted love, and when that such love sees suffering, the response is compassion and the wish for welfare and well-being. And when that heart of love sees something that's wonderful, whether internal or external, wherever, however it is, the pure, natural, normal heart, tamata, in line, in harmony with the Dhamma, heart of love is joy, and appreciation, gladness. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's the natural movement of the heart of love in response to something that's good, something that's well, something that's blessed. That when the heart is not tied and bound and restrained in its natural, wholesome, healthy qualities of love. And then the two, like the bookends here, the upeka part also, like upeka, in a way upeka is actually a quality of all of them, right? Because the kind of the stayness of upeka, whether high or low, thick or thin, come what may, whatever it is, able to hold everything, able to pass through everything, the kind of depth, all of that that's there, it's like it's a quality of all of these. So some of the teachers say, like, you go at them from one end, go through. The metta is a quality of all. In fact, when we talk about unconditional love, or even when we talk about what we say is unconditional love, but it's not really, but it's just like all kinds of, really, you know, all kinds of conditions, like that, for all kinds of conditions. All of that has the, on the one end, it has the quality of upeka, and on the other hand, all of them have the quality of love, that kind of quality of upeka. We're talking about like a quality of love that we call the unconditional love. It's like I'm with you through absolutely everything, whatever it may be, like that, Yeah, and what it's saying, this is like talking about unconditional love, this kind of depth, bravery, courage, heart. It's like the parami kind of qualities of it, right? That is able to pass through everything. That is beautiful and noble and excellent and admirable and worthy. That kind of quality. So yeah, the bookends. If you would, it's like the upeka kind of quality goes into all of them to make them what they are, and also they're all qualities of love. The upeka is essential for the love and for the compassion and for the mudita, for us to be able to. For us to be able to. So then, if we're talking, when we talk about love and compassion, You may have trained to think like that, but what does it mean to think about mudita with such kind of quality of heart and depth? Not the kind of, I mean, often we start with small and shallow things, right? So I don't necessarily want to call them an enemy, because if the first thing that we think of is something small and shallow, and that's where we get a sense of equality, okay. But that's not the end of it. We're obviously, we're talking, and we know for the love, we know for the compassion, we're talking about something much deeper, you know, deeper and broader, that has the depth to pass through life and death and absolutely everything. We understand for the love, for the compassion, how that's so, but what does that mean for mudita? I challenge you for this. Have you done this depth of work with this particular quality? Or have you just been around with like what was called the near enemy? I don't want to call it the near enemy, but I'm trying to talk about avoiding the self-aggrandizement and self-depreciation, and setting those extremes aside, accessing the path and opening it up. And then the path is broad and deep and wide and vast. What are we talking about? This kind of quality of heart that's liberating. These are called, the Buddha called these, all four of them, and the whole package like this. As also apamana means limitless, boundless, abundant, immeasurable. Have we looked into, have we experienced, have we practiced? We may have practiced with that kind of love, with that kind of compassion. Have we touched into that kind of quality of mudita? And if so, why not? I'll just tell you, I just noticed, I think there may be some cultural reasons, and there are also underlying some translation reasons, which are very common translation reasons. And then if someone hasn't read the Pali text themselves, then they might, or thought in a kind of contemplative, discerning way about it, what, but it's like the same pattern for all four, except for number three is different. But in this context, we can be blind to it, because the assumptions from that are there within Christian culture about this will validate that. Then of course it's like that. And you just stop right there, and then you don't open up this avenue. It's a natural part of the natural responsiveness, natural fluency of the heart that is healthy, of the heart that is nourished by the path, of the heart that is strengthened and purified and liberated by the path. That avenue doesn't get opened. That one remains stunted. Stunted. The other aspects get open, but in that part, the strength, the healthiness, the beauty, the fluency, the integrity, the nobility of the Dhamma of our heart, oh, piffle me. Oh, poor me. Oh, poor us. But really, even to have a sense of what that is, even like preliminarily to allow ourselves, then I'm talking about this kind of mudita, like congratulations and like this, and me too. Initially, I feel like the Grinch. Grinch. Grungy. Grungy, grouchy, Grinch. Yeah. I have my Grinch time also. I even like the Grinch at Christmas. I love that Christmas story. It's one of my favorite Christmas stories. Really, I enjoyed the Grinch. Something inside ourselves, it's like it just feels wrong. It doesn't feel intuitive. My heart doesn't go there. Doesn't go there easily. Why? Stunted. This avenue of the past not opened up. Then opening it up, I tell you, like if a part has been blocked, that's a whole big part like this, we can feel the, like the absence of the energy, and the absence of the healthiness, the absence of the joy. Sometimes we see it in like the foreign teachers, and they're practicing with these things, and where did they get that from? How did they access that? How are they doing that? I hear at our Dhammadharini monastery and hermitage sometimes, we had the conversations with some of the people, and I'll tell you now in the language of the scholars, then I'm going over time. As it's the secrets, inside stories. Then some of the people who the scholars call the convert Buddhists, then are seeing some of the, who the scholars call the ethnic Buddhists. And then the convert Buddhists notice, we're here together, why are those ethnic Buddhists so joyful? The Sri Lankan people, the Thai people, it's like they just have a fountain of joy inside themselves that's just bubbling up and welling up, and here we are. What is this? I doubt the Buddha's teaching. We're doing the exact same thing together, darn it. We're here, we're offering something together, we're doing some volunteering together, and why is it, darn it, that those people are just like have this fountain of welling up joy and happiness inside themselves that just seems like innate to their beings, is so beautiful. And I am a dedicated Buddhist also, I'm a dedicated practitioner also, I've been practicing for years. Why is it that they're like this here and I'm doing the exact same thing as them and I'm not? I'm not. How do I access? And thinking and then sometimes asking privately on the sly. Why is it we think we're better than the ethnic Buddhists? We're really practicing. We're really studying the Dhamma. I'm really studying the Dhamma. I'm really meditating. I'm actually keeping the precepts. And why is it that I'm like this, and I know I'm practicing hard, faithfully, for years, darn it, and then why do they show up, and they're just, you know, they're just an ethnic Buddhist, and then they're so joyful, like that, and so happy, just to be, like, offering some food, or volunteering for something, or... And then they sit down, and then they just go into samadhi right away like that. After talking and laughing, and they didn't even spend the whole week in silence. How is it? Why is it like that? Is it just because I was born in a different culture, so I don't have access to these things, and it's just cultural, or it's just ethnic, I don't have it in my genes. They must have it in their genes, but I don't have it in my genes to be like this, and... You know why, and maybe I'll pretend. These things I heard behind the scenes, the inside story about this. So I want to talk about this part. Thank you for reminding me about the time. It's time. Now should be the time. Oh dear, here I thought this time I want to give plenty of time for discussion and question and answer and... Oh no, it's 7:55. It's time for metta, for the Sangha members. It's time for dedicating merit. But I hope to have made the point and to just say from personal experience, as someone completely raised in this culture, who has also experienced what I've been talking about, even being immersed in it, day after day, year after year sometimes, then actually it is possible to open up. If we know, if we understand, if we allow ourselves to,
and it's so excellent and wonderful. It's a liberating quality, and part of it's in making our hearts whole, complete, nothing stunted in our abilities, and to experience the excellence and wonderfulness, beauty and joy, well-being of the Dhamma and of this path. Our inheritance, our human inheritance, having contacted the Buddha, this teaching, and the Sangha jewels. Excuse me for going over time.